people talking bad about the way we have to live here in this country. Harping on wars we fight and griping about the way things ought to be. And I don't mind them switching sides and standing up for things they believe in. When they're running down my countrymen, they're walking on the fighting side of me. Yeah, walking on the fighting side of me. Running down the way of life, I'm fighting and talking that key. If you don't love it, leave it. Let this song I'm singing be a warning. You're running down my country, man. You're walking on the fighting side of me. The guy who claims he just don't believe in fact. And I wonder just how long the rest of us can count on being free. They love our milk and honey, but they preach about some other way of living. When they're running down my country horse, they're walking on the fact side of me. Yeah, walking on the fighting side of me. Running down with life, I'm fighting in a hard fight. If you don't love it, leave it. Let this song I'm singing be warned. When you run down my country, man, you're walking on the fighting side of me. Yeah, walking. If you don't love it, leave it. Let this song I'm singing be a warning. When you run down my country, man, you're walking on right beside me.
Good evening, this is Paul Fromm, and you're on the fighting side of me here on WeightResistanceRadio.com. Well, lots more news and views for our people, and of course, those are the European founding settler people of the Dominion of Canada, the United States of America, the Dominions of Australia, New Zealand, the Republic of South Africa, Rhodesia, and all of you who may be listening this morning in the European heartland. Well, so much to talk about today. I was on my way back from beautiful British Columbia to Ontario today, and I picked up the morning Vancouver Sun, and in there was an article, LGBTQ, plus rather, or whatever plus is, activists must reject anti-Zionism. Now, this has actually been an issue, it's kind of interesting, at a number of so-called gay pride parades. It was a big issue for several years, probably will be again this year, in Toronto with the Toronto Gay Pride Parade. The issue is that there is quite a contingent of anti-Zionist homosexuals. That is, they're opposed to the some of the behaviors of the State of Israel. Well, on that issue, I cannot disagree with them. But anyway, that caused a great deal of concern because many senior homosexuals are Jews. So that many of them proclaim themselves to be deeply wounded, and this might actually detract from the degree of support that they could give to the to the gay pride parade. And it became a real hissy fit issue over the past couple of years in Toronto, and apparently it is also an issue in Vancouver. Now, normally I don't particularly give a flying flip about the hissy fits within the LGBTQ XYZ community on issues like this, in my opinion, just as with their issue, at least the Toronto LGBTQ crowd, a couple of years ago with Black Lives Matter. See, 2016, they invited Black Lives Matter in Toronto as special honored participants, some people say, as security. But of course, this is, if they were in fact invited as security, this is more self-serving nonsense. They're already guarded en masse by the police. And so what happened, and this was really quite comical, partway through the parade, the Black Lives Matter people simply sat down. Well, okay. You know, come on, don't say anything nasty there. Anyway, they actually blocked the parade. They didn't just sit down and refuse to march anymore. but they blocked the parade, and they had certain non-negotiable demands, which were, among other things, to hire more black LGBTQ types. What else did they want? The police could henceforth, the Metropolitan Toronto Police could not participate formally, that is, march in the parade. Now, of course, they can't very well prevent them from guarding their useless rear ends, but they can't actually march in the parade. And I gotta say, I find myself in a dilemma. I think it's a disgrace. The police would be officially marching in the parade. Can you imagine police marching in white pride? What are you racist or something? Anyway, such is the nonsense of our times. But to get to the issue at hand. Okay, so this is an Israeli Jew by the name of Hen Masek. Yeah, Hen Masek is an Israeli Mizrahi. As Pride, well, actually, it's not Pride, it's Gay Pride. As Pride Week continues worldwide, I feel lucky to live in an era when the LGBTQ plus community is visible and acknowledged in so many countries. At the same time, I'm disappointed that even as an openly queer individual, I can't fully celebrate with the international LGBTQ plus community while many of its members fervently fight against me and my country, Israel. Aww. As a queer Mizrahi Jew who's faced an intersection of discrimination, it's shocking to witness LGBTQ plus people who know firsthand the struggle to gain acceptance continue to engage in a campaign to persecute me because of my nationality. Well, I'm not sure they're actually trying to persecute him personally. They have an issue with Zionism, as do many of us. But anyway, okay. Over the past several years, I have seen pride marches across the United States and Europe demonstrate a bigoted approach to Israelis and Jews. The most infamous was in 2017 when the Chicago Dyke March ejected three Jewish women for waving a rainbow flag with a Jewish star of David on it. Organizers later explained that their cause was explicitly anti-Zionist and women were removed because the flag was similar to the Israeli flag and the law and the flag's long history of use in pink washing efforts. You really are kind of torn on this one. Whose side you come down on? A pox on all of them. So they continues on. This cynical accusation demonstrates just how casually pro-Palestinian progressives will erase the Israeli LGBTQ plus community, ignoring both our struggles and achievements. While we are still fighting for same-sex and civil marriage adoption rights and parenting legislation that will not discriminate against LGBTQ plus individuals, gays such as our community openly serving openly in the military and in parliament are evidence of a country heading toward progress, not away from it. Goes on to say that LGBTQ plus people aren't recognized at all in any other region in the Middle East, including the West Bank and Gaza. In fact, the 2014 Pew poll of the Palestinian territories revealed that only 1% of Palestinian respondents believe that homosexuality is morally acceptable behavior. In the words of Talin Abu Hanna, a Palestinian citizen of Israel who became Miss Trans Israel 2016, I wouldn't be alive if I grew up in Palestine. I've got to say that, assuming that poll in the Middle East is accurate, that the people in the Middle East, both predominantly Muslim but some Christian, seem to have a more traditional and balanced sense of morality than they do in Israel, where they're openly homosexual people serving in the Israeli military and in the parliament, and there is a much more wide acceptance of the LGBTQ agenda, and that's not surprising because very, very prominent in pushing the LGBT agenda in the West are Jews. Anyway, he goes on to moan and groan some more. I implore progressive and LGBTQ plus activists who've joined this campaign, that is the anti-Zionist campaign, to think twice. It's a vile effort designed by a coalition of anti-Zionist organizations to manipulate others into fighting their own political war against Israel. Ultimately, they're... Okay. And what I noted on the paper is something that in the hierarchy of persecuted minorities. No, for all the prattle about equality, there is a hierarchy. And of course, standing at the very top of the hierarchy are the Jews. So the most persecuted minority going currently are the Jews. Coming in somewhat second would be the whole sexually bizarre, the LGBTQ crowd. And then behind them, the blacks, or maybe around the same place, the blacks and in Canada, the Native Indians, all of them boo-hoo-hooing and complaining and carrying on and wanting special privileges and so on. Now, here is a really mischievous piece of garbage also from, this is from, oh, actually, it's about 6 months old. Toronto is right now caught in the middle of something called Raptors Mania. And if you're not a follower of basketball, and I am not, but if you're not a follower of basketball, you might say, what at? What's this Raptors Mania stuff? Well, the Toronto, almost entirely Negro Raptors, that's a basketball team in the NBA, are in the, they're in the playoffs. They're leading, as of tonight, 3-1 in, I guess, the championship. But anyway, one of the Raptors players is a guy by the name of Curry. Yeah, like as in the Indian food. But he's not Indian, he's Negro. And here's a story. Live on TV swore against Ayesha Curry, that's the female, that's the wife of, a Raptors fan accused of making a vulgar comment about the wife of NBA star Stephen Curry on live TV, has now been charged. Oh, you arrest the guy. Well, what did he do? Police say 28-year-old Tristan Warkenton of Toronto turned himself in last Thursday and faces a charge of mischief by interfering with the lawful operation of property. Workington is accused of uttering what police call a profane comment, no, profane phrases, in an interview with a TV reporter following Game 2 of the NBA Finals between the Toronto Raptors and the Golden State Warriors a week ago Sunday. Officers began their investigation on Monday after a man was being interviewed outside Toronto's Scotiabank Arena referenced Ayesha Curry and shouted a vulgarity. Curry, who grew up in Markham, Ontario, is an actress and celebrity cook. So he was being interviewed. Presumably the press wanted to interview him, so that he was being interviewed, and he uttered, "We're not privileged to know what it is." A vulgarity, and the police are charging him. I mean, what an absolute messed up country. She is a Canadian American actress, a celebrity cook, and produced a cookbook, etc. And she's married this this basketball star, anyway, what I find so precious, and this is, you know, perhaps one of Canada's most pro free speech papers, the National Post, but even it won't tell us what exactly it was that was said. Cruise the internet to find out. The story tends to the case is the latest in a string of incidents involving the same vulgar taunt that has been shouted at female TV reporters during live appearances. It's actually a habit, apparently. Back in Halifax in December of 2017, CTV Atlantic reporter Heather Butts was broadcasting live from a downtown pub during a hockey game when Nash John Gracie made a crude gesture and uttered a sexually explicit comment. The 25-year-old Gracie took responsibility for his actions through restorative justice and agreed to community service and so on. Once again, though, we are not privileged to know what it was that the person said. it's not so that I have such a prurient interest in all this, but I find it I find it part of the suppression of free speech. I mean, the person is actually going to be charged. Doesn't the public have a right to know what the guy said? Ayesha Curry has frequently been interviewed. She's not just a basketball wife. She is because she also has her own career as a as a cook, and cookbook author, and so on, it would seem that we ought to have at least be told what it is. Yeah, let adults decide. Whether it actually deserves criminal charges. Anyway, I guess If anybody can actually find out what the so-called slur was, email it to me at paul@paulfromm.com, and I'll be glad to air it. The issue here is once again the media control. This is a criminal matter. The fellow is going to be charged. Is charged. Whether he'll be convicted, that might be a different matter. But he is charged. This is a matter of public information. I'll go further than that. We have a right to know whether the justice system is being properly used or is it being abused. I mean, there's a concept in law called de minimis. That means concerning trifles. And the notion is that the law does not concern itself with trifles. This is definitely a trifle. Now, if this man said something vulgar, well, okay, shame on him. But this should not clog up the court system. But, you know, one might assume, though I don't think necessarily so, that there's a racial overtone to this. The reason is that, if memory serves me correctly, the slogan that is being used around female reporters is actually a sexual vulgarity. Okay, no credit on the type of people who do this, but come on, give us a break. Anyway, this is actually a story from about 5.5 months ago. It's an opinion piece by a fellow named H.A. Hellyer. The pick-and-choose problem with the UK's efforts to protect persecuted Christians. To their credit, and there isn't much I could say to the credit of the Theresa May government, but apparently to their credit, as to the credit of the previous Harper government in Canada, they are taking an interest in the persecution of Christians. And Hungary's Viktor Orban has said has a state secretary, Prime Minister has a state secretary for the aid of persecuted Christians. And he insists Hungary is a Christian democratic country. Christians are the most persecuted religious belief group in the world. And that is inhumane. The Mr. Hellyer's or H.A., I assume it's a he, sniffs that Hungary is infamous for policies that promote anti-Muslim and anti-Semitic discourse around Europe. Orban has made it clear that Hungary is a Christian country. Well, many people have wanted Canada, the United States, and Britain similarly defined as predominantly Christian countries. This doesn't mean other people don't have the right to practice their faith or to believe as they choose. This is not a theocracy, but on the other hand, that it is our history and tradition. Well, this really sticks in the craw, big time, of the Zionist lobby. But anyway, well, what's this guy's problem? Okay, Hellyer says, this is back in December, British Foreign Secretary Jeremy Hunt announced that he had ordered a review into what the UK government could practically do to protect persecuted Christians worldwide. It would be tempting to see this as an isolated move from within Britain to combat persecution, a genuine and broad problem that definitely affects Christians. Well, he does admit it affects persecution affects Christians, particularly in the Muslim world and also in India. That would be somewhat inaccurate. This is a trend in the United Kingdom and in Europe, more generally, and profoundly problematic one too. At best, it apologizes for autocrats overseas, and at worst, It leads to condemning non-Christian refugees to die in boats in the Mediterranean Sea while airlifting Christian ones to our lands. Well, now this is just plain hooey. The majority of those pouring across Africa, across the Mediterranean, into Europe are in fact Muslims, yes. But in many cases they're being accepted. They're not being condemned to die while Christians are flown in first class to Europe. That just isn't the case. There are certainly Christian communities that need dire assistance. And he references sectarian violence against Christian populations throughout the Arab world, well, particularly Iraq. rather than prioritizing persecution of religious minorities per se, reports, according to the Guardian, the quote, unprecedented Foreign Office review is specifically directed at the persecution of Christians. Why? Because this reflects the Foreign Secretary's view that since Christianity is established faith in the United Kingdom, it's legitimate for the state resources to be devoted to the review. Well, of course. In the state religion of England is Anglicanism or Protestantism. Again, there's religious freedom. People are free to practice other forms of Christianity or other religions. but one of the titles of the English monarch is Defender of the Faith, and that is the Anglican Christian interpretation of the faith. In other words, Christianity. That's what England is. Well, of course, that really sticks in the craw of the particularly of the Zionists, who don't particularly like Christianity. But he then goes on to say, even if that were not the case, it's deeply troubling that the government of a multi-religious liberal democracy would argue that its co-religionists overseas deserve privileged treatment. Especially, one might add, when the country's ruling party has not dealt with bigotry against religious minorities sufficiently at home. Now, come on. Religious minorities. Jews are in a privileged position in the UK. The people who criticize Muslims can face jail in the UK. There are no persecuted religious minorities, unless, perhaps, even back home, there are Christians. But given that, let's assume that the government there actually wants to pay particular attention to persecuted Christians abroad. Why not? Why not? England is a Christian country, or a predominantly Christian country. Of course, they should give priority to their co-religionists. That would. Now, I don't think that's actually happening, but at least theoretically, that should happen. this is extremely important that we give priority to our own people. Yes. This is not one big universe of equality. There must be prioritization of our people first. That isn't wrong. That isn't some sort of vile racist discrimination. This is just plain healthy. And, of course, that does not meet with... obviously does not meet with the approval of Mr. Hellyer... and probably with many other spokesmen. here's a blast from, unfortunately, not exactly the past, but in December 2016, rather, among the first contingent of illegals pouring across the border from the United States into Canada, taking advantage of what they thought was a loophole in the law. It's actually not so much a loophole in the law, but a deliberate area where the pro-invasion forces in Ottawa are prepared to allow illegals into the country. But mostly across the Quebec border, in an undefended, unfenced area at the bottom of the Roxham Road, but also some of the first batch poured across into Manitoba in the middle of the winter. So in January 2006, no, it was December 2016, Saidu Mohammed snuck in across the North Dakota-Manitoba border in the middle of a blizzard and froze his stupid fingers off. A refugee from Ghana who lost all his fingers to frostbite crossing irregularly into Canada. He didn't cross irregularly. It wasn't as though he was wandering around a field in North Dakota and somehow ended up on the Canadian side of the border. It wasn't irregularly, illegally, deliberately. He's a criminal. He made an impassioned plea to members of Parliament recently to scrap proposed asylum seeker rules that the government is belatedly, with an auction coming up, trying to pass into law. Mohammed's story of crossing a snow-covered field between North Dakota and Manitoba focused attention on the border in December 2016, a reason that he was asked to testify before the House of Commons Finance Committee as it studied the proposals of the government's bill. He avoided official border checkpoints in order to make a refugee claim. Yeah, he scammed us. And you see, the scam only works because the government takes an absolutely literalist approach to the Third Safe Country treaty that we have with the United States. And what that treaty says is that a would-be refugee has to make his refugee claim in the first country he lands in. That's a safe one, and that's between Canada and the United States. So, Saidu Mohammed, was in the United States. He'd come there, and he actually made a refugee claim there, and he failed. Didn't think he was a refugee. He's from Ghana, which happens to be a democratic country. How can he be a refugee? One might ask. Well, yes. So that means he must make his refugee claim in the first country he comes to. And if he's turned down, he cannot go asylum shopping. Okay, you say, well, that seems pretty clear. Well, why did he think he could sneak into Canada? Well, I think they already, and this is organized, incidentally. I think they were signaled that if they showed up in Canada, not at a regular border crossing, you see, that's it. If you show up at a regular border crossing and say, I'm a refugee, you will be told, well, you're supposed to make your claim in the United States, as obviously you came from the United States. But if you sneak across the border, you know, so you don't go to a regular border crossing, we then go into mental gymnastics that would be do tribute to a Talmudic scholar. And here are the gymnastics. Well, we pretend we actually don't know where he came from, because he didn't cross at a normal border crossing. You wandered across a field in Manitoba, well, or you may have crossed at the Roxham border area in Quebec. So we say, well, we don't know where you came from. Well, what do you mean we don't know? You came from the United States, obviously. But what else? You know, you didn't fall out of an airplane, and presumably you weren't on a pogo stick in Mexico and took a couple of jumps and flew 1,300 miles and ended up in Canada. Of course we know where you came from. But the government, instead lets them make a refugee claim. Well, that takes months and most, actually, sorry, not months, it takes several years. Meanwhile, they're on welfare. We're providing housing and job training, perhaps, and medical care, and. What's really going on here is that almost to a man or a woman, the people using this are from the third world. And that suits the game plan of the people planners just fine, because the end game of Canada's immigration policy is the replacement of the European founding settler people. And whether they came in with formal papers or, as they like to say, irregularly, that's just fine. The story goes on. Mr. Mohammed said the rules would likely have barred his ultimately successful application if they'd been in place 2.5 years ago. Deporting me back to Ghana would destroy my life. I would be imprisoned or tortured to death, he told the committee. I don't want this to happen. One might ask, why would he be tortured to death? We're not told. Meanwhile, the cost of handling these illegals just goes up and up. To handle the cost of housing and services for those illegals, the federal government has given Toronto a loan, $71 million, with a further $7 million to Ontario's municipal government. To Ottawa's municipal government. Lisa McLeod, Ontario Minister responsible for immigration, renewed her demand a week ago for government funding to pony up $200 million, as she says, the feds owe the province for asylum costs. She said, the meager amount of support that they have provided to our two largest municipalities falls tens of millions of dollars short. It does not cover any of the education costs, which is $20 million. It does not cover any of the social assistance costs, which is $90 million, and falls far short for our major municipalities. What they're doing is the federal government is basically allowing itself to preen its radical pro-third world and anti-white credentials and offload the costs on the municipalities. Something of a blast from the past, but the government is belatedly, and I say this quite cynically, belatedly going through the motions of appearing to do something in the hopes that the voters will not notice. And we'll vote them in or back. Here's an interesting item from Texas. Police downplay fears of over three trans killings. That's transgender people. U.S. police investigating the third murder of a transgendered woman in Dallas in under a year have played down fears that there's a serial killer targeting one of the city's most marginalized groups. How are they marginalized? If you're a freak, if you do not accept the gender you were born with and mutilate your body and so on, come on, how are you marginalized? You're marginalizing yourself. Chynal Lindsay's body. Now, that Chynal, heaven knows, but is that a name? Chynal Lindsay's body was pulled from White Rock Lake in Dallas on June 1st, with obvious signs of homicidal violence, Dallas Police Chief Renee Hall told a press conference after the FBI had been called in to help. Lindsay's murder came 2 weeks after another black trans woman, Lazia Booker, was shot to death. These are black and transgender. Mulazia, M-U-H, LAYSIA. Mulasia Booker was shot to death. Third trans woman was fatally shot in October last year. Hall downplayed fears on the part of the LGBTQ community that the serial killer was targeting trans women. Very often these are unhappy people living a dangerous, what's sometimes referred to as a dangerous lifestyle or life choices. Sometimes associating with other dangerous people where drugs and other nasty things are involved. I'm not saying you deserve it, but your parents would have said, I told you so. This is a dangerous life choice, the dangerous behavior. You're dealing with unstable, in many cases, freaky people, and bad stuff happens. Not to say that's good, no, but that might be predictable, and perhaps it's a result of the choices you made. Well, this is Paul Fromm, and you're on the fighting side. I'm going to play a little bit of Hank Jr. tonight. Hank Williams Jr., of course, a star in his own right, but when he started off very shortly after his father's death, and Hank Williams Sr., the great Hank Williams Sr., died all too young at age 29, when Hank Williams Jr. was just a little boy. Hank Williams Jr., when he started out, actually as a child singer, was in the early years urged to always sing his father's song. And he did. As he grew older, he somewhat tired of that and wanted to be a singer in his own right. Wanted to have his own brand of music. And that's, in fact, what he did over the years. And I think quite successfully. Anyway, here are some Hank Williams Jr. Songs, beginning with All My Rowdy Friends Have Settled Down. This is Paul Fromm, and you're on the fighting side of me here on WhiteResistanceRadio.com. And this is Hank Williams Jr. All My Rowdy Friends Have Settled Down. Thank you.
tell us how it really was when you was working with Daddy?
Well, in 1950, I took a little nip along with Mr. Williams on the way to Mississippi. We were stacked 18 in a packing limousine when we met this promoter in the town of New Orleans.
Well, the man told Daddy he had what it took, and he liked the way it sang, and he liked the way it shook.
He said pretty soon he'd make us all rich, and we started believing that fat song bitch.
Now, Daddy told the man, if you want to make some dough, take a little money and put me on a show.
And we played them dates, and we filled the places well, but Hank, he done blew the profit all hell, cause he run to a 10, and he run to a 20, and he run to a 100, till the party didn't go.
Like a big double pump to a little bitty fella, he spent about another $100 show.
Hank looked at me with a funny looking grin, said, I've been to the opera, and I'm going back again. We met the owner in a little office there, a big fat fella with some artificial hair. He told Hank he wanted half of everything he made, or he'd have to tell Audrey about the women Hank had laid.
And you told Daddy you better get smart, get rid of them fellas, and make a new start.
He fired my ass.
Story of some of the shenanigans of Hank Williams Sr. Well, this is Paul Crom, you're on the fighting side. I'll be back with you again tomorrow, same time, midnight Eastern time. The show is repeated at 8 in the morning, 4 in the afternoon. All these are Eastern Standard Time. And I sign off tonight, as I always do, with the anthem of the real Canada. The Maple Leaf Forever.
In days of yore from Britain's shore, Wolfe the dauntless hero came and planted firm Britannia's flag on Canada's fair domain. Here may it wave our boast, our pride, and joined in love together, the thistle, shamrock, rose, and twine, the maple leaf forever.